Senate Committee on Judiciary Work Session Agenda, Wednesday, May 7th, 1975, 8 a.m., Room 407A.
Expressly say that a person's name or a candidate's name cannot be withheld from the ballot unless there's a court order for that. And this amendment is made to a section which says that the Secretary of the State or a filing officer can verify statements made in various documents that are required to be filed. So basically, once the person, the filing officer, certifies to the county election official that these names are to go on the ballot, a name cannot be withheld from the ballot by a filing officer unless there is a court order. There was some question raised as to whether or not subsection 3 should remain in the bill. I think that does clarify the changes in the bill. Specifically, it clarifies subsection 2, which talks about the court determining whether or not a person is qualified for office. And it doesn't limit those offices that the court can review and see whether or not a particular candidate is qualified for the office. If it does remain in the bill, though, I would suggest a couple things. First, I would put after 3, notwithstanding subsection 2 of this section, to clearly indicate that you're referring back to subsection 2. And I also think that some other provisions in the elections laws, such as ORS 263.55, which allows the court to deny a person of an office if he's found to have violated a criminal law relating to the elections laws, I think that should also be amended to put a similar provision there. The reason is that if we place it only in this particular section, I think it opens the argument that, well, here we say that the Constitution is to prevail, but perhaps in the other section where we also talk about denying somebody an office, perhaps the legislative intent was that they were trying to do something other than what the Constitution provides. Simply clarifying, we could either delete it and let the constitutional provision prevail, or if we leave it in, I think we should also try to stick it in the other sections that allow for a person being taken from office.
I think this would be a good bill for us to try to establish an orderly judicial procedure for determining whether or not the Corrupt Practices Act has been violated by a candidate in the general election for the legislature, while at the same time avoiding the constitutional problem if possible. And how does that language in the state constitution read? Does the state judge the qualification? Does it have some other... What I was, while he's looking that up, my thought would be this, Wally, and I think we were talking about this, to include language that would clearly authorize the court on what would be similar to a declaratory judgment to make a determination as to whether or not the Corrupt Practices Act had been violated. Factual determination. That's as far as they could go and at that stage, as I understand Sunderleaf versus Gruner, interpreting this section here. 11. Each house, when assembled, shall choose its own officers, etc. Judge the election, comma, qualifications, and returns of its own members. Okay. Now that could mean a lot of things. But...
Pretty well on point, though.
Yeah. Now, what about amending this to provide, and I, John or someone, we can work out the details, it may not be very hard, clearly provide that a court shall have jurisdiction to determine the question, determine, find, and determine the question of whether or not a candidate for the legislature has violated the Corrupt Practices Act. Then, however, recognizing that only the House itself can has the power to deny that person the office. The law that we passed, you know, we thought this could happen before until Sunderland versus Groner, when the court held that it was uniquely within the authority of the body, and I think that's probably right. I think that probably follows the Anglo-Saxon tradition, but we have this problem. I don't have to really tell you that once a person is elected, there's a strong tendency to ignore the law by the House for one reason or another. I mean, sometimes it's partisan, sometimes it's trade-offs. I one time since I know there was a trade-off on two candidates. Not officially, but as a practical matter, there was a Republican challenge and a Democrat challenge, and it was washed out. And other times it's for some other reason. So you end up, nothing's being done. The Corrupt Practices Act is a dead letter as far as general elections and legislators are concerned, I think. This, I think, would give it life if we do this. And then how's the legislature? Here it is. They found candidate X violated the Corrupt Practices Act. All right, now, legislature, are you going to seat this person in the face of that?
Did we provide sufficient teeth in the Ethics Commission for them to have any kind of sanctions in a general election?
I don't think they have the attorney.
I doubt it.
We have some bills, though, in the local government. Well, that would be the other way, of course.
but what would it? I'm concerned. I'd like to see some. First of all, a legislator is not, I don't think, is a good person to be judging these things. I'd rather have some more
of that. We've got a lot of history with Congress judging its own members.
Very rarely does it do anything.
Well, that's very true. It has. Maybe we haven't had an aggravated case.
It wasn't an aggravated case, but it just made the law. I mean, this point was raised by Keith Burns, as I understand it. He kind of raised it by the way. He claimed he really wasn't his main argument.
We were involved in suing Groner. Yeah.
Pardon?
He was Speaker, and Bob Davis and I and somebody else were the committee that reviewed after the petition.
Yeah, I'm not saying that was an aggravated case, but I think that
partly was partisan.
But what do you
think?
Well, I'd like to know, does anyone else agree with me that this might be a good place to work on this? It might be an idea worth pursuing. What do you think, Bob?
Well, I understand what you're trying to do. It appears to me, though, that unless, even on a question of violation of the Corrupt Practices Act, even then, if there were a conviction, if Groner had been convicted, the case would still be before the House, and this judgment would still be made as to how aggravated it really was. And in the Groner case, for instance, if the court had said, yes, you did those things, I don't think, frankly, that the House would have taken his seat away from him anyway.
I think one of the
questions. I recall this situation.
Any interest in the bill as it is?
None for me.
Okay. Let's try 5-10.
What I meant to finish was.
Okay.
Yes, that if it were an aggravated Corrupt Practices violation, then I think action might be taken.
Well, now, here's the thing that I'm saying. Now, the kind of unaggravated case is one that wouldn't probably qualify even in the primary now as the law was set up, I think, in Cook versus Corbett and a couple of other state cases, namely an inadvertent technical violation of the Corrupt Practices Act would not be a basis for removal in any circumstance.
Right.
You have to find, in effect, mens rea, intention to violate the law. That was found in the case of Cook versus Carver. Clear intent, the court found, to violate the law. And then you have to find an actual violation that is substantial in a sense, I mean, not just a minimal thing.
Even in Cook versus Carver, I think it would be very questionable with the case Carver using the incumbent business.
Of course, that wasn't the ground. Have you read the case?
No.
You can't rely on what the newspaper said about it.
No.
It's totally erroneous. You have to read the case to know what was in the case.
All right, what was the basic?
Well, in that case it was found that it had been pointed out to Alice Corbett by Gary Gortmaker that she was making some false statements,
mm-hmm.
and he recommended to her that she take them out.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't.
Of the voter sample.
Also, she was saying re-elect to position number 8, which was specific, a clear false statement as to the position that she'd held, and she was at a specific one. And also she used the term senator when she wasn't a senator. There were at least, they had two or three clear false statements plus adequate warning. I even had lunch with her treasurer and told her about it, you know, and still refused. Clear case of knowingly doing it from hell or high water. So,
even then.
Well, maybe you just never will throw anybody out. I mean, I think...
Madam Chairman, I think Vern's got a good point, but I think where we are in the session and the whole thing, I think it'd be fatal to this bill to try and make a major change now. So with that in mind, I'll move Jones' amendment to 88.
The amendments have been moved to 88.
What are they?
To put in the notwithstanding paragraph 2, so that the 3 keys a little tighter into 2, then add that other section that
is 355, which has to do with removing somebody from office for a criminal violation of the election law.
I've got one better for you, Wally. Why don't we just take out 3, and then we won't need with notwithstanding. So do that. I'll and make the other technical, and I'll support the motion to send it out.
Well, if you take out 3, you don't need to make the other.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
We don't have a vote to send it out anyway.
We do if all 4 of us agree. Well, you're not going to vote for it.
Okay, what's next?
I withdraw the motion. Ian Rose, Temple Park, which is in front of the
why didn't you tell me that 20 minutes ago? I told Betty knows this.
Man,
it was nice talking about it.
Madam Chairman, this bill was brought back to the committee mainly because of the language down on lines 29 through 33 on page 2, and the first segment of line 1 on page 3. The reason being that if the commissioner, labor commissioner, were to, before he could decide whether or not he was going to affirm or reverse, he'd have to look at the record, and if you were going to look at the record, he may as well read all of it personally, as is required by the Administrative Procedure Act. You have in your packet a proposed amendment from the Labor Bureau. What that amendment would do would be on line 29 of page 2, after reserving to himself, simply insert after an appropriate review, and then delete lines 31, 32, and in 33, record and then it would read, reserving to himself after an appropriate review, whether he will affirm, reverse, modify, or supplement the decisions or order of the special tribunal or hearings examiner.
What does that do?
Again, the amendment is designed to get around the requirement of the APA that the person who's going to make the final decision in the case personally review the record, or at least...
terrible. What does he want to
awful.
Excuse me, go ahead.
If he doesn't read the entire record, at least those portions that are designated by the respective parties, I would suggest as an alternative to this, simply put, reserving to himself or his designee whether he will affirm, reverse, or whatever. There's no requirement under the APA that the commissioner himself, or under the bureau statutes, that the commissioner himself make the decision which constitutes the final order. And if it is a matter of a large number of cases and difficulty reviewing personally the entire record, we could certainly say allow the commissioner to designate someone from his staff to do so, and that would constitute a final order for the purposes of appeal.
I don't understand that. That would be the first,
and I think the more desirable alternative, and that is to simply say reserving to himself or his designee whether he will affirm, reverse, modify, or supplement the decisions or order.
Let me see what the effect of this is going to be. What will that do now? If he reserves to, you add his designee. Is that all you would add?
Yeah.
Right, now, what would that do?
In addition to deleting the same language that the Bureau of Labor proposes, so you'd still delete lines 31, 32, and 33, record and.
Now, what would be the practical effect of this now? Let me see. The present law now, the proposal as we have it up to now is that either if he leaves the examiner's findings alone, he can without doing anything, okay, and let those become final, right?
Yeah.
But if he gets involved in the case, then he has to read the whole record before he can reverse it. Isn't that what the bill as
reverse,
drafted?
Reverse, modify, or supplement.
All right. Now, this would do what? You mean that he would be able to come in and do half a job now?
Well, under the bill as proposed, the question that's asked is, well, if how can he really determine whether or not he's going to do nothing with the examiner's findings unless he reviews it to some extent? Or how can he really determine whether or not he wants to affirm or reverse it unless he reviews it? And if he does, shouldn't he review it personally as is required by the APA?
If he does decide
to review it at all, determine whether or not he's how can he determine he's going to simply accept the examiner's decision without in some way reviewing what was done.
Is there anything, if the bill were passed in its original form, that would prevent him from having someone simply read it?
I would say no.
He can find out, if
he were going to affirm it. I think under the bill, as it's drafted, he could have somebody else do it. It's not that clear, but I think that could be done.
He himself or someone else could read it over to decide whether or not, or read segments of it, couldn't he?
Yeah.
Reading the thing doesn't commit him to taking it under total review, does it?
The amendments do that, too.
Well, the amendment would allow him to take some formal action, wouldn't it? What would the amendment do that he can't do now?
The amendment, say, from the Bureau of Labor would simply require or put into the statute that he's going to have to review it to some extent. I agree. It's not going to change.
Or his designee.
Well, the Bureau of Labor doesn't include that or his designee. The changes proposed by the Bureau of Labor's amendments probably would not change the law or the bill as it has been amended that much. There still would be it would require only a cursory review if he were going to affirm the thing. And there is the possibility, I would think, of his having a member of his staff do that. The amendment which I propose would require whoever reviewed it, either the commissioner or his designee, to still comply with the requirement of the APA that is placed on every other agency, and that is for the person who's making the final order to personally review the record or those portions designated by the parties that they think should be reviewed.
All right, so with your amendment, your proposed amendment, not theirs, your proposed amendment he'd be able to look at it, which he could probably do with the bill in his present form, or have someone else look at it. Right?
Yeah.
All right, your bill would just kind of formalize that. Plus, it would still retain the requirement that if he is going to reverse it, he has to read either the entire file or at least read the entire portion designated?
No, my amendment would say, regardless of what he's going to do, affirm, reverse, or whatever, whoever reviews the thing pursuant to a final order has to personally review either the entire record or portions of it.
So that's not really changing the present bill much, is it? I mean, the present bill, the way we...
Well, the present bill, the intent of this language here is to get around the requirement that the person who makes the final order personally review the record. That's the intent.
Yeah, this
and
gets around it too, doesn't it?
No, I don't think. Say, the amendment which I proposed is not. It would... the provisions of the APA would still apply, and either the commissioner or his designee would have to personally review the record.
Somebody would have to personally review it if they're going to change the hearing officer's finding.
Or if, even if they're going to affirm
it. Or affirm it. If they're going to act on it at all, they must review the entire record. Now that's under your amendment.
Yes.
But that's true under the bill as we have it here, too, isn't it?
No.
I mean, as we amended it.
No.
Well, you mean he could review it and still, without reading, he could act upon the case without going through the full record under the bill as we amended it?
Yes.
Right. How could he do that? I thought that
well,
we had required.
Well, that's why the bill is here, because we don't think he can do it.
I thought that's why we amended it, was to make sure that if he was going to act in any way, he was going to do anything as to the original, and that he had to go all the way. Wasn't that our original?
Now, if you look down on line 32 of page 2, in any case where he's going to affirm the decision, he can do so without reviewing the record.
Yeah. Now, won't that still be possible in this case?
If you adopt the amendment which I propose, that will not be possible. It will require either the commissioner or his designee to personally review the record.
Oh, what a affirm. But if no one challenges the finding, then there's no question of affirmation, is there? No one challenges the hearing. Exactly.
That's right, yeah. If there's no appeal from the
hearing. Well, isn't he required to do this now under the present law, what you're suggesting?
Yes,
yeah.
He is. But his designee is not authorized.
Right.
Oh, I see. So really all that this bill will do is to allow him to designate someone else to do this in his place.
Yes.
Rather than getting around this requirement of personally reviewing it, it would simply say somebody other than the commissioner can actually do the reviewing.
Oh, and that's all done?
Mm-hmm. The motion is before us. Is there any objection to the motion? The motion is adopted. Is there any motion to the bill?
I'll move forward to pass it.
Not that Bert understands it.
Yeah, sure. I think he knows it better than we do now.
Well, I'm very curious. The motion is passed. A and Gross, Pennsylvania 510, the board is passed as amended. Clerk Paul Roll.
Carson?
Aye.
Cook?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
I'm
going to have to tell my General May story.
No, I hope so.
806.
There should be amendments in your packet to this bill. If you remember when this bill was heard, there was one witness to testify, and that was a Mr. LeMaster from Corvallis. And he testified representing several groups of elderly people, and he would like to allow individuals to place personal property into joint tenancies so that they can basically avoid probate. The property would pass without having to go through probate.
Well, that can be done now with the right language, can't it?
It's questionable. Under the statute which prohibits or abolishes joint tenancies with regard to real property, It's never really been
Harrison
definite.
Versus Harrison.
That's right. In that particular case, they left open whether or not you could create, say, this these life estates with right of survivorship.
Approximately.
Yeah. They really left open the question whether or not you could do that with personal property. And they expressly said, we don't rule on that issue. There have been other cases that say that you can't create a tenancy by the entirety, that is, where you have husband and wife with personal property in Oregon. So it's, the law really is not that clear whether or not you could create one, the same thing that is currently created with real property, the personalty, to get around the abolition of the joint tenancy, and two, whether or not you could, say, create a tenancy by the entirety with regard to personal property. And really, they are concerned, I think, mainly with a husband and wife situation.
Well, I think it's a good concept. I think I thought we passed a bill some session before for a while. And then every time I had one, I had more property passed through my wife and me because of the lack of this law.
This amendment,
no,
I might...
One. No, that's a different thing. I think Erickson versus Erickson relates to real property, where survivorship between non-husbands and wives. That's right. That's Erickson versus Erickson. But the same thing would apply to personality here, isn't it, essentially?
Well, there has been language in the case of saying that this statute dealing with realty, which abolishes joint tenancy, does the same thing with regard to a joint tenancy involving personality. There's never been expressly held that, but Erickson v. Erickson, they also quoted another case seemingly affirming that, where they say that they don't, that this statute does tend to also abolish joint tenancies with regard to personality.
Now, do you
want to
address your amendment?
This amendment is taken, for the most part, from the state of Washington statute in this matter, and it was the statute that Mr. LeMaster put forward as to what he thought should be substituted for the language in Senate Bill 806. There are just technical difficulties with the language in Senate Bill 806 in that it uses real property language, this conveyance of personal property. He's much more, I've shown him this particular draft, and he likes it. He thinks it does what he wants it to be done.
That's Shane Allison,
isn't it? I know he has.
Yeah, but he thought the first one.
Where is this? Is this supposedly in the packet somewhere?
Yeah.
I wonder if you've seen John.
No, he hasn't. I have changed the language, though, that he objected to so that it is geared towards personal property. I agree with him that there is a question whether or not you can create a joint tenancy, at least presently, in personal property under Oregon law. But putting this in the statute, definitely that would get, take care of that.
Why don't we do the same thing for, let's add a joint tenancy for real property, too.
He wanted, Mr. LeMaster wanted to do that, too, but I don't think the title of the bill.
Well, if we had it,
well, there's another reason, too, John.
You might be able to explain the history of that better.
Well, I had a bill in for two sessions to reestablish joint ownership of real property, and I think it's a very meritorious bill. I think it's a mistake that Oregon abolished. We got our law from Indiana. We got part of it, but not all of it. And most states abolished joint tenancy and then reestablished a new kind of tenancy, joint ownership or some other function. We abolished joint tenancy and never reenacted the other. In 67 and 69, I made a major effort to change that and had all the law professors from all the law schools, and we had a brouhaha for weeks on that thing. And it's a very complicated, and I still think it's a good idea, but in fairness to those who strenuously object, there are some serious ramifications in the way we hold property, and it's a very difficult area, and most of those experts are opposed to the change. I think they're wrong.
Anyway, move the amendment to the bill.
I'll move the amendment.
Is there objection to the amendment to the bill? The amendments are adopted.
You can move it out, just that? I'll move it out, just that.
Move it out.
You might have to stand back to back when you carry it, though.
Discussion. Let's go.
Carson?
Aye.
Cook?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye.
House Bill 3040.
Madam Chairman, I think that should be 3240. That's a typo.
Okay.
Madam Chairman, on this bill, no one, it was set for a hearing and no one testified on it. The purpose of the bill is to provide for greater or increased amount of good time for persons or inmates who are at work camp. The existing computation of good time at work camps, you can see that down on lines 31 through 34, where one day is deducted for every 10 days of work during the first year of prison employment, and then one day for every six during the any subsequent. This would change it so that during the first year it would be one day deducted for every 6 days. And then after that first year, it would be one day for every 4 years. And once they reach this 1-to-4 ratio, then that would apply to any other work or educational relief.
You have a letter from Jay Goldstein. What's that handwriting on the bottom end?
Necessary for work to be done at on camp.
Madam Chairman, that was a note that I got from the AA of the committee that I believe it was Human Resources that had this bill before our committee. And she indicated that someone from Corrections has said that this may require some fiscal outlay to improve the work camps. Because they anticipated more people going to them as a result of this. I don't know whether that necessarily follows from the change that this bill makes.
What about the, has anyone discussed the desirability from the standpoint of of handling the prison population aside from the fiscal implication? Is this a good thing?
Nobody's testified on it?
No.
Well, Madam Chairman, I don't oppose it. It might be a good bill, but that'd be a hard one to explain to the people. The reason they voted is to reduce the population in the penitentiary. Of all the times to pass a bill.
We could adopt the Priestley Amendment and give everyone a key to his own cell. We could reduce it even larger.
Yeah, right.
Right. There is no motion on 3240.
Maybe a great idea. I think it'd be a good idea, Madam Chairman, really, if we hear from someone else.
Yeah, I'd like to hear from someone in Corrections. I don't mean to, as Jay Gould's comment, but boy, for all the reasons not to vote for a bill, he should put his finger on it. I don't know whether he's trying to kill a bill or not.
Let's look at 2539.
Madam Chairman, this is a bill that was introduced by the District Attorneys Association, and it would allow affidavits to be used in grand juries where the district attorney has shown good cause why the witness can't appear. An example was given where you've got a theft of a motor vehicle where the owner may be in another state and you wouldn't want to go to the expense of calling the person up twice but before the grand jury and then at trial.
Any, would we have jurisdiction for perjury?
You wouldn't be able to get a hold of him, I guess. Have jurisdiction, but you probably couldn't get in here.
You need to name that California.
so. The affidavit would be intended for use in Oregon where the statute provides that a crime begun in one jurisdiction is completed in another concurrent jurisdiction on both. So I would think so.
Any amendments needed?
I don't think so, Madam Chairman.
Any motions?
I'm a little concerned. I heard it the other day. It sounded all right on the face of it, but on the other hand, it could be abused, I would think. You don't, well, there's no, what ordinarily happens when you have a witness before the grand jury? The members of the grand jury are able to question that witness. They're not going to be able to question someone with an affidavit. Are you concerned with that, Wallace?
On line 8, Madam Chairman, I think that should be court administrator rather than court administration.
That's probably okay in the law, or is it?
I'm not sure.
Probably.
Why, Madam Chairman, why is this limited to one county if it's good for...
It's not limited to one county.
Well, the why would it be limited to judicial districts that have only one county? Why not, if this is good, why not just make it generally?
Well, Stoltz said the question of paying, who pays, who's hired, and where, all that kind of thing, becomes trivial expenses. Yeah.
So that does. Well, I'm Madam Chairman, I wasn't here at the hearing, but I'd like to take out this on line 5. That you're only talking, they're not talking about more than 25,000 a year. If they can't figure out a way to divide it up even in a multi-county judicial district, there's something wrong with them, I would think. But I would move that we delete on line 5 the word single county. So that any judicial district, the may, and again, it's optional. It doesn't say shall. This just gives them the discretion. It would seem to me if it's appropriate for a judicial district that has a population of 70,000 or more, is made up of one county. I can't think of a reason why it wouldn't be just as appropriate if it had more than 70,000.
They discussed that, and there were problems on the House side.
Who's they? Let's fire...
I don't know. No idea, but I hate to mess up the bill.
I don't mind it. I think what's good for Multnomah County is good for the rest of the world.
I don't think so. You never.
No, really. Here, logically, I'd like to hear. I'd like to hear a reason why it shouldn't be if we're all of them.
Well, if
you
had been here, you could give testimony.
Who's that? Where is there anything written here? He may have given testimony for his. Is this Stoltz's bill?
Right.
Was there any testimony on why it shouldn't be extended to other counties?
Yes.
Just what we mentioned, the costs of trying to, the problems of trying to allocate the cost.
Again, since it's optional with the judge, before he decides to do it, he'd find out whether he can figure out a division of the cost. Well, it's probably a good bill, but I want to take that single county. I'll move that we eliminate the word single county on line 5.
Motion is to eliminate single county. Roll call.
Carson?
Aye.
Cook?
Aye.
Smith? Madam Chairman?
Aye.
Carson?
Aye.
Cook?
No.
Smith?
No?
That's just pretty. I think it's all right. You satisfied, the preacher satisfied the one concern I had about whether it would apply in the case of Muhammad Ali's black Muslims or whatever it is, and apparently it's broad. The idea is as broad as the draft board's idea. It simply would be a question of fact, I suppose, whether this was a sincere religious ritual rather than just some
$10 purchase
of a certificate.
Are there any further amendments?
Madam Chairman, as I read the intent of the amendment made by the House bill, they're limiting it to confidential communications, and I think that it would be appropriate on line 20 of the printed bill, page 2, to preface communication there with confidential to tie those two things together.
And so moved.
Is there any objection? I move the amendment. Is there any objection to the amendment? The amendment is adopted.
Is that in more than one place?
It's in another place, but in line 19 it's referring to the communication, which would refer back to confidential communication.
All right.
So
all right.
It's necessary to amend that.
Madam Chairman, on line 18, I move after the word clergy to insert and police.
What?
Well, if you can screw up a bill, so can I.
I don't know if the committee knows, but I was accused of one of Smith's sins by the Oregon Journal the other day.
Right.
And they praised me with faint dams the following Monday. Did you see their retraction?
Uh-huh.
Well, that's about as minimal a retraction.
It slipped in was still there.
First they said I did, and then they said I didn't slip it in.
Well, you slipped in that diversion program, and we also provided that the first offense would never be recorded, so there would always be a first
With friends like that, I don't need enemies.
Carol moves. 2767 as amended to the floor of the discussion. Clerk Paul.
Carson?
Aye.
Cook?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Well, were you convinced by Judge Olson that this is a bad bill?
I was. Not by that first one, but the following three.
The next 15 really did.
Yeah. All right, there's no motion.
I move we table it. 3089.
Move to table. Clerk Colonel.
Carson?
Aye.
Cook?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
No.
Here we are trying to help the chairman clean up.
Just
the
clean
book.
Up her book.
There's a lot of help going on here.
Now this is a good bill, isn't it?
I still don't know about it.
Madam Chairman, this bill.
Wait,
I'd rather not.
Why don't we have him explain it to us so the next time it comes around?
That would be a help. Hardy did a good job, but I just haven't studied it.
almost all of the provisions in this bill are substantially similar to provisions in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. The first two are sections 2 and section 4 have to do with requests for the production of documents and things and entry upon land for inspection and other purposes such as taking pictures or getting samples of the land and so on. Section 4 is a request for an admission of fact and the genuineness of documents. Both of these are discovery techniques short of going to court. If the party upon whom the request is served fails to comply, then there is a provision later in the bill which allows for the compelling of compliance by the court upon the motion of the requesting party. Section 5 starts out laying out the authority for interrogatories. And again, this is very close to the language of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Section 6 indicates to whom the discovery requests have to be sent. Section 7, who must sign objection to various discovery requests. Section 8 provides for an order compelling compliance with an interrogatory or a request for production of documents or a request for an admission. On page 6, subsection 3, it gets into what remedies the court has if a person who is ordered to comply with a request fails to comply or fails to obey the court's order. Section 9 is a device to protect the person from whom various documents or admissions are requested. It allows for a protective order that the court can issue to prevent the party seeking discovery from getting what he wants. Section 10 just has to do with supplementing compliance with the various discovery techniques. And Section 11, again, is straight out of the federal rules stating what the scope of discovery would be.
You know, Wally, on this bill, the reason I'm not too familiar with this myself, but the main reason is that I've had very few cases in federal court. But the one thing that I think is involved, this would make it easier for we who don't practice much in federal court to get the information we need in an involved case, like a product liability case, where under our present law, it's just damn near impossible to get the kind of information you need. This would make it possible. I really think it's a good thing for the average trial lawyer in this state. We almost passed this in 19.
We had a lot to do with the maybe we passed it.
The insurance industry, actually, we almost got this through, I think it was the 1959 session. And then Posey got the idea that it would be bad, and he worked out a deal with the insurance company, and I don't know who did who in, but anyhow, they recalled the bill from the governor and killed it. Ever since then, people representing, now the insurance industry used to oppose this. Every time we tried to get it through, they would oppose it. Now, apparently, they're not opposing it, and so it really is a good bill, Wally. Would you be willing to vote for it if I move it out now?
I haven't read it, that's my fault. I apologize to you. I don't have any problem with it, but I'd like to read it.
How about tomorrow, Madam Chair? I mean, just on the agenda.
I'll read it by then.
132 and 187, I believe, so as well. 132 is the uniform.
Madam Chairman, there should be in your packet a revised 887, which is the proposal really before you. This is a revision based upon cooperation between Mr. Joss and also the ACLU representative that testified here when 887 was up for a hearing.
Where is the mesh copy?
It should be in your packet. And this was the revised copy was the copy that was discussed and talked about at the last hearing of these bills.
Has this been revised since the last hearing?
No. No. The chief difference between the two approaches is that 887 makes some amendments to the affiliation provisions in existing law, but nothing substantial. It deals primarily with a situation where there is no father, or there is a putative father, and the mother wishes to have the child put up for adoption, and it deals with the necessity of conforming Oregon law to the Supreme Court decision of Stanley versus Illinois, which said that a father, a putative father, had a right to notice in a hearing before parental rights are terminated. Sections 7 and 8 in this revision are really the guts of the bill.
And what what page are they on?
Starts on page 7. Excuse me.
5? New 7?
Let me take that back. The new 8 that starts on page 6. And simply lays out a requirement for notice and exactly when the court can terminate rights or allow a child to be adopted if the putative father does not appear. Mr. Joss is of the opinion that this will bring Oregon's law in conformance with the Supreme Court ruling.
All right, now, Section 8, how do we read this here? I'm trying to... Where the paternity of the child has not been established, the putative father shall be entitled to reasonable notice, etc. Now, how, what if the mother doesn't know where?
There is a provision on that in here.
Well, it's limited, though.
Subsection 8 limits it.
Yeah. So there'd be no notice required unless the child had lived with the putative father.
That's right. Basically, it tries to establish elements that would give rise to the putative father's right to notice. And that those are listed there if the person has lived with the father or the father has contributed or endeavored to contribute to it before then. These elements give rise to the right to notice at hearing.
Where's the disagreement?
Stanley wasn't that limited.
No, it wasn't. As I say, this is Mr. Joss's interpretation of Stanley. He thinks it meets the requirements. It was also agreed upon by the representative from the ACLU.
Where is the disagreement? In other words,
the main disagreement. Wynn Coffins, who testified on behalf of 132, has no disagreement with Mr. Joss's amendment. However, he is of the opinion, and I agree with him, frankly, that you could pass Senate Bill 132, deleting Section 25, which is the section that really deals with notice where there's an adoption. You could pass, say, 132, deleting Section 25, and then pass the major portions of Section 887 dealing with notice and hearing where there's an adoption. That could be done.
what's Bill think about that?
I'm pretty sure he doesn't agree with it. He does not want to see that happen. I think he would agree that it could be done, but he doesn't
why?
Agree with it.
Could I ask Bill why?
Why?
I think it's messing up both bills.
I see.
Coffin's bill has a lot of meat and a lot of good to it, but it also has a lot of bad, from nitpicking to more serious. I'm afraid if combined, both bills would fail this legislature, and we've got an unconstitutional provision to adopt the statute that's essential to do it. I've told Coffin and everybody that I'd be glad to, I'm no expert on affiliation, but I would be glad to cooperate during the next 2 years in perfecting affiliation proceedings that his bill endeavors to do and to mesh it with 887 if it is enacted.
Well, now, if they're in two separate bills and dealing with different subjects, how could they foul each other up?
They don't, though. They deal with the same subject, affiliation.
Well, no one of this has to do with adoption.
Sure, I'll move the amendments to.
I'm sorry, adoption.
To 887.
Well, the 132 has to do with affiliation. The other one has to do with adoption, isn't that right?
Madam Chairman, if I might, 887 does amend the existing affiliation sections in Oregon law. But as I say, the main thrust of 887, as I understand it, is in those sections which I indicate, which had to do with notice and hearing to a putative father where, say, there's going to be an adoption proceeding.
Chair moves the amendment to 887. Is there any objection to the adoption of the amendment to 887? Amendment to adoption.
I'll move it out of that, Chair.
Well, I'm going to vote against tabling. I could save you some time.
Yeah.
Madam Chairman, on 132, and I really suspect that it's an important thing, and I'm not as well informed as I ought to be, or at least I've listened. I think I've been here all the hearings, but it doesn't seem to necessarily sink through. I think it would be good if we could ask the sponsor of 132 to come here when we have time to spend.
He's been here twice.
Well, and I'm having a third time, so we can really, when we get down to it, to answer some of these questions. Now, John, our counsel, indicates that he thinks it's probably all right. Isn't that the way, is that correctly interpreted?
Well, before I answer that, I think that 132 is a well-drafted bill. I think there's integrity to it, but at the same time, as I say, 887 could go out as is, and you could keep the existing statute. 132 doesn't make that many changes to the existing law in Oregon. The one thing it does, it allows for a pretrial settlement of affiliation proceedings, and it gives the judge the power to require a blood test to be taken prior to trial in affiliation proceeding, trying to handle it as expeditiously as possible. It also deals with who is the father where there's been an artificial insemination, which is probably not that significant a question, but it's not answered in the existing Oregon statute. Those are, in my view, the chief differences of the two bills. Other than say, as I say, I think that 132 has more integrity as a bill in dealing with the whole matter. But
well, I think, Madam Chairman, we would You've already kind of been through it 2 or 3 times, and maybe another time we could really intelligently decide, I mean informally decide, whether or not we really ought to pass it or really ought to table it. And that's why I suggest we arrange one more time.
You might do it. One might, with 887 out, what changes would you recommend? The 132 to match what we've done in 87. We might talk about that at that meeting.
Okay.
931. The letter you're holding from Dick Sands about it.
Madam Chairman, I appeared and testified before, and I couldn't remember whether I had or not. I read the summary of my testimony, and I don't know what I can add. Conceptually, I don't think you can do this, and I think I made the point to the committee before. Conceptually, I also think you ought to be able to. It's a constitution that will take through this.
Why would you have recommended it?
Well, I guess you weren't, I'm sorry. The principal concern I have about the thing is this. If I correctly understand the bill, it is a bill to provide for pretrial diversion in the classic sense in which it's now being attempted in a number of jurisdictions, including the federal Brooklyn plan. All of those programs contemplate that the defendant, with the advice of his counsel, prior to any adjudication that he has in fact committed any act or subject him to the jurisdiction of the state, agrees to perform some kind of act, to perform some kind of probationary act, under threat of prosecution if he fails to perform them. I don't think that's constitutional. I think there has to be an adjudication, and we went through this with respect to SB1. I think there has to be an adjudication which establishes that the state has some authority to require this individual to do something before he can then have that club held over his head.
Why?
Well, I don't believe the consent is valid at this point. It's coerced. And I think it's coerced in the constitutional sense. The irony of it all is that who's ever going to raise it? The lawyer who advised him to do it in the individual instance is never going to, because he thinks his client got a good deal or he wouldn't have advised it. The only time it'll ever come up is on a petition for habeas corpus where a fellow who is into the program suddenly decides to become too onerous, changes lawyers, and then there's a habeas corpus petition.
And nothing will be hurt then.
At that time, and that's a terrible risk that the guy's put to, because, of course, as soon as he brings a habeas corpus petition, he's subject to the prosecution. I think what we might find as an outcome in that situation, depending upon where the suit was brought by, I assume it would be brought to federal court, I think we might find that, one, the act was declared unconstitutional, and the second, we were barred from prosecution. And that's just, you know, one lawyer's uninformed opinion. I think Jacob's of a similar opinion. I know Jim Henning agrees with me with respect to this whole question of pretrial as opposed to post-adjudicative treatment. And I thought it were possible, because I think it's a good idea, but I just don't think it is.
Okay, the chair moves to me with the bill. Clerk Palmer.
Carson?
Oh,
aye.
Cook?
No.
Smith?
Aye.
Chairman?
Aye.
No, very briefly, Mike, on that privacy bill. Is there any middle ground we can go? Do we have to take the minority or the majority, or is there any place else?
I don't think you should take either one. I haven't talked to Lee about this, by the way, so I'm just speaking for myself.
Show up tomorrow?
No.
Yeah, right.
No, let me explain. I was more in sympathy with the minority view, as I think the chairman's at least aware of, because I think, to put it the way Jake does, bells once rung can't be unrung and ought not to be treated that way. And I thought thought that Don Sterling very well expressed the point, too. The best check on government taking people off the street is to be sure that we preserve those records. Because of that, I think Section 18 needs to go. And in fact, the original intent of the minority report was that Section 18 not be in the minority report. But there's something wrong with the minority approach, too. If all of that information the minority approach intends to make public is in fact made public and available to the public on demand, the police are not going to be able to get information from certain states because those states place greater restrictions on the availability of the information they transfer under their information gathering and distributing system. In order to be sure, to give you a quick example of how badly that could foul things up, let's suppose the minority report were adopted, which would make everything that's a matter of public record someplace available on demand here. And let's suppose that an individual's criminal record, and this Jake's whole discussion of rap sheet was inappropriate because rap sheet is not what we're talking about. A rap sheet's a record of every time I was fingerprinted. I've got a rap sheet even though I've never been arrested. But let's suppose that a person's criminal history shows that he was arrested and convicted in Kentucky twice, arrested and convicted in California three times, arrested but not convicted in Indiana twice, arrested and convicted in Oregon twice, and arrested a third time. To disclose all of that information would mean that Kentucky and California would immediately stop sending us further criminal justice information because their own statutes provide that we can't disclose such information. To work it out any other way would mean that those who have the information, the state police, would have to work out a culling system by which they'd have to separate the California information and the Kentucky information, which would go only into criminal investigatory files, from the other information, which would go into the criminal history file.
What's the effect of doing nothing?
The effect of doing nothing is to let able investigative reporters like Jerry, whose last name I forget, from the Eugene Register Guard, do what they've always done, get their hands on rap sheets because they know somebody who knows somebody. The thing about it is you need to do something. If you don't, there's going to grow up a black market, which is already growing, in this information. And I really think the best approach of all is to take Section 18 out of the bill. That's the expungement, or expunction. I guess I'm told there is no such word as expungement. Take the expunction section out of the bill, and then enact Senator Brown's SB 860, which is for consumer and business affairs, which would make it an unlawful employment practice to make an inquiry with respect to prior criminal history if amendments I'm preparing now are adopted, as long as there's any rational connection, unless there's some rational connection between the prior criminal history and the position for which the person applies.
Are you preparing amendments in line with my concern, which was that the bar not be permitted to ask those questions either to applicants for the membership in the bar?
I'm not sure whether it would cover it or not. It's intended to, but I'm not sure whether it would.
Can you check that out? And other agencies, I don't think it should be limited to the bar.
It's intended to cover. It's intended to cover any employer.
This
the bar is not an employer.
This is a licensing agency.
All right, I can draw it broadly enough to do that too.
And MDs, chiropractors, optometrists, the whole business. It
no.
shouldn't be permitted
it should
to
be
ask.
All right. But yeah, I can draw it broadly enough to include them too, and
well,
I agree with that concern.
Well, whatever it
well,
is. In other words, the expungement. Now, for example, in Consumer and Business Affairs, we had testimony that the bar application says, have you ever been convicted of a crime, had it expunged, requested to be expunged, and had it expunged, which totally defeats the purpose of expungement.
Now, I think the chair and I are in disagreement with respect to, one, to who ought to administer this, and second, to how broadly some inquiries ought to be, how broad the permission ought
to
be.
Yeah, but we're not in Consumer and Business Affairs.
But
well,
we can fight
well,
that out
there. Is there any way in this bill to preserve a right to put something in there to indicate what happened to an arrest which wasn't followed by a conviction?
That's the real need. The need is to make sure that whatever records are kept, that they're up to date. And most of the bill accomplishes that if you take Section 18 out of it. You don't need 18 to accomplish the rest of that.
Which would require them to show the ultimate disposition of
that's
the
right.
trial.
The rest
of course,
of the bill would
the other thing is this criminal review board.
Oh, we don't want any
well,
boards.
I'll tell you what they contemplate by that board. That's information you didn't get yesterday. There is a present board which does virtually the same thing. And what was contemplated was the governor would simply change their name and reappoint them. There's a 9-member board that's doing essentially that now.
Does what? What do they do?
Well, they're responsible for seeing to it that data system collection services of the kind we are talking about are kept accurate and up to date and use modern techniques and so on. This is simply expand their function. Now, if you want to get rid of that function, fine, but somebody's got to offer in a check. One other thing that's ironic about the bill is that the legislature is not a criminal justice agency. And in theory, at least, in practice, that maybe it's not such a problem, but in theory, at least, none of you are entitled to find out whether or not the law that you passed is being put into effect, at least not between sessions. There's no way any one of you can conduct an investigation to find out, which I find a little worrisome. I think you ought to be able to inquire.
There's really two sides to this. I am concerned with Sterling's argument about the suppression or hiding of criminal records. On the other hand, there's this concern about, maybe the ultimate concern can be taken care of by requiring, with the bill as amended, requiring that every record of arrest, if it's shown at all on this criminal record, must show the ultimate disposition.
Well, philosophically, that's unacceptable to a broad number of people. The theory being that your neighbor from down the street, just because he takes a dislike to you over the fact you let your dog run loose, ought not to be able to tar and feather you throughout the neighborhood by going to his local police agency and saying, what's the criminal history of Wally Carson, and finding out, by golly, 35 years ago, he was convicted of rape and armed robbery, and since then has led a model life, but that information is on the book.
Why don't we allow the individual to have it placed in the confidential file? Now, that's not going to show a record. Is that necessarily going to interfere with the investigatory reporter? If I can go in and ask that my record be made confidential and only released on court order or with my consent?
It is going to interfere, yeah. You've just got a balancing function to perform.
Yes, yeah, of course it would interfere, but probably not. The local gangster isn't likely to go down and do that.
Well, if we showed the disposition of arrest, who would do that? The individual, or whose report would it be?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
We get an arrest, and there's no conviction.
All right.
Who's going to show them?
As the bill is now drawn, and ignoring my Section 18 concerns, there are a series of affirmative requirements in the bill which require the agency responsible for the arrest or for the disposition of the offender who has been arrested to report to the system what has happened, and there are deadlines set in which that report must be made, and there are provisions that it's a violation of the law not to have made those reports. So basically, there's just simply an affirmative duty on the agencies that are involved. The individual at any time can go in and ask his own to be sure that it's correct, and if he finds that it is not, to demand that the agency holding the information correct it. There's a relatively expeditious procedure by which he can get the correction made. Anytime compilations of this kind are made, there are going to be omissions, and I think the bill is pretty well drawn to see to it that the individual who is the victim, quote victim, close quote, of such an omission can take care of it in a hurry. The bill in most respects is admirable and deserves passage. There are those cotton-picking philosophical problems with respect to the availability of the investigatory press and others that I come down on one side of and other members of the committee come down on the other side of. But Section 18, the one that would unring bells by just simply declaring some things never happened, that's the part that really bothers more than anything else. And it was that part to which Jake spoke and Jim Henning spoke and Don spoke. Because, and part of the reason, part of the concern about that, forgive me, Senator, for just a second, is that they imply that you go back and you take the original police blotter record that says, Juan Hernandez was arrested on the night of March 15th, 1975, and you seal that, you expunge that, you destroy that, and an investigative reporter who thinks that people of Mexican-American extraction are being harassed by the police, by the sheriff's office of some county, for instance, if the information isn't available any other way, can't even go to the individual police blotters and begin checking because the information may have been destroyed.
If you took out Section 18, provided that the individual had ready access to files to correct them with some ease. I just don't see why the problem exists with making it public. Yes, it is.
Again,
so if you take out Section 18, and you give the individual the right to correct the record, and you put the onus on the agency to keep it accurate and current and correct, then I don't see the real concern about making it more public record.
That starts to approach a middle ground if 860 also passes.
Well, philosophically, I like what Senator Smith was saying. The only difficulty I have is that we're really talking about a much different age than, say, a long time, say, the right to know 100 years ago. The difficulty is how quickly information can go over long distances, and where you've got an individual who, granted, he can correct that record. He can correct it, say, at a police station in a particular county. But you really don't know to what extent he's corrected that through these various arteries across the country. But I...
Could you require the agency to send in, disseminate to the same place as the agency?
That sure requires that.
The reason I think his proposal is good, this information has not generally been available at all in the past to the members of the general public.
Only to some, to those who knew somebody who knew somebody.
I remember one time.
In other words,
I remember one time I wanted some of that information, and I asked a lawyer that had access that they wouldn't do it. They knew how to get it, but they didn't want to open up their pipeline to outsiders. And so, if we restrict it, we're really liberalizing the availability of information. Really, anything we provide is more than most people can get now. So, if we put these strictures like you're suggesting, or we're suggesting that it must show the ultimate disposition, we're really opening it up more than it has been before. Do I make myself clear? In other words, we're really not putting a crimp on anybody's file.
If the one exception, you have gotten to the last point, that is going to be a public document at that time. That's the ultimate. That's where the minority report went to.
Make it a public document.
I make it available to members of the public generally. Sterling's argument being that the fact I declare myself to be a reporter makes me no different than any other member of society.
Which I agree with.
By means of that declaration. It would appear from the First Amendment work that I did in connection with the Darris case that in fact is correct. That the press is only mentioned in the First Amendment just to make sure nobody misunderstood. But the intent is that the freedom that's involved in the freedom to speak and express, at least, and that's been expanded to include the right to know, is everybody.
I think the other very strong argument that was made was the argument that how do you check on the police authority's work if you do not have a public record of arrest and how to dispose of the arrest and how to dispose of the conviction, and how do you judge your not only your police record but your judiciary?
The funny thing is, the greatest sympathy I find for that point of view, other than in me, and I've worked with the police long enough that I think I've come by my distrust of a few police officers, honestly, the greatest sympathy I find for that point of view is in honest cops who really are concerned about anything that might serve as a vehicle for corruption and collusion between dishonest officials and the police, or collusion among the police themselves that would permit them to hide or give them a vehicle for hiding what it is they did that was wrong. Maybe we're puritanical about it, and we ought to be watched because of that. But anyway, there's an approach in it. There's a view in that direction. But I still think the point has to be made that one of the principal concerns that gave rise to this whole bill was the fact that there is an indiscriminate inquiry being made whenever someone wants to do anything in this society as to what his prior criminal history is. And there has grown up a practice of insisting that he disclose it in one way or another. And I think a concomitant of adopting any part of the minority approach, assuming we can work out the problems with interstate information, and I think maybe we can with some effort, but a necessary concomitant is to make it an unlawful employment practice to make any such inquiry unless the inquiry is directly related to the function the person is to serve in the job for which he's applying, or even in the broader sense that Senator Cook suggests with respect to licensing.
Why can't we just lift that and put that in this bill? That's relevant.
I think Senator Brown's bill's a better vehicle.
But it's in another committee, and how do we coordinate these things to know that they're going to go to the same place?
Yeah, they get the same.
Well, if you're sympathetic with what I'm saying, it's a monumental task, but I'd be glad to try to put the whole thing together.
I think it'd be better in one package. Yeah, so why don't we, if he's willing to do it, see if you can take that concept and stick it in this bill.
Okay.
Can you do it with this title?
Oh, yeah, it's relevant. It's obvious. The only question is relevancy. Really, and that it is relevant.
That's what I think. Criminal justice information system.
Yeah.
Yes.
Sure. That's relevant.
It'll fit. We still have to settle the question, though, that you and I talked about today with respect to whether you want the Labor Commissioner to enforce that.
A little further away than I might be.
Well,
I'm not sure how far away we are, because if I can just get 6 hours of time all in one block, I can write the amendments and tighten them up enough so that the only problem that remains is the California-Kentucky kind of communication thing, and I think I can solve that with OST. It may have some physical impact in the long run, but I think we're under an obligation to see to it that we both protect our sources from outside the state and at the same time disclose whatever we possibly can inside for open society purposes, if nothing else.
Now, you're saying the Labor Commissioner should...
I'm saying he ought to be the one who has the authority and the obligation to see to it that these inquiries are not made either directly or indirectly, that the employer neither inquires of a prospective employee with respect to his prior criminal history nor obtains the information in another way for purposes of settling on whether or not he'll employ him unless there is a connection between the job for which he's applying.
Yeah, but we still have a problem. Who's going to say whether there's a connection?
Yeah.
Well,
always a connection.
We entrust that same kind of judgment now to the Labor Commissioner with respect to inquiries concerning race, religion, political point of view, and sex. Philosophically, at least I'm not bothered by the idea of giving him the authority to make the inquiry here, too. It's his line of work.
Well, how's it going to get when an individual goes to him, applies, he either has to answer the question or he doesn't have to answer the question, and how are you going to send it to the Labor Commissioner?
Well, let me suggest this, Betty. Couldn't he, basically, you say that if you're going to ask a person about prior conviction, you say, have you ever been convicted of a crime involving theft or embezzlement? Or if you happen to be hiring someone who's going to be working as a clerk at the cash register. Now, that would seem to be relevant.
Yeah, you can have that labor question.
That's just it. What I would suggest is this. You affirmatively make it unlawful. I know how. That's even scarier to me than it is to you, because I'm the one who has to defend what he does down the line, and I've been through some disasters lately in that regard. But I think what you do is this. First, you affirmatively make it an unlawful employment practice to make any such inquiry. And then you provide, however, where there is a connection between the job that is being offered or the license that is sought and a particular crime, the Labor Commissioner may, by appropriate rule, establish the manner and the form in which such questions may be put. And you can even require the Labor Commissioner to give prior approval to such forms before they may be used. And then you can delay the effect of the bill long enough, say 8 months, so that there's time to make an adjustment between present employment practices to give the Commissioner time to draw rules.
I'd like to
think
about that.
Yeah.
That's got a chance.
Good. Yeah, I'm for it. Why don't we have him go ahead and prepare something, then look at it.
Well, I just see all kinds of horror stories. And first of all, delegating to the Labor Commissioner, the kinds of rulemaking power that you're talking about is giving him the right to determine discrimination with respect to the question asked. I just don't think
that
point is going to be allowed.
Senator, excuse me, he has such, I understand, your concern, but he has such authority now with respect to inquiries regarding race or national origin or religion or sex or age. There's a bill in for age, pardon me, but he does have it with respect.
Don't we take the approach that you can go ahead and ask about it, but you can't discriminate because of it?
I don't care how you want to go at it. My,
well, I mean, that's how we deal with age and sex and the rest of it, is that it's not unlawful to ask the age of a prospective employee.
Well, you can't ask about race at all.
Well, the federal government, you know, has switched clear around on that. Now you've got to ask about
I know they have. I know they have. That's a federal preemption situation.
Yeah, well,
and they're doing it because they've decided that in order to effectuate certain national policies,
yeah,
and
they're Chinese? No.
They're not. they're not under, the federal government is not under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. You don't read it backwards into the original Constitution, so they're not faced with the same constitutional difficulties the state is. We couldn't do it,
mm-hmm.
even if they can. What the law does provide, and as I recall, this is by rule of the Labor Commissioner, again, you may make an inquiry with respect to race if there's some valid reason for restricting racially the employment. As for instance, if you're putting on a professional play and you want to, the play is The Green Pastures, you could require that all the applicants be black, because that's a play about a black preacher and his congregation and the way they envision the Bible, the way the youngsters in the Bible class envision the Bible, envision the story. So there are, you know, valid reasons for doing so. I can make a try at it if you want to go at it that way. And you're going to significantly expand upon a bill that's already big, but either through 860 or through this vehicle, I think in order to deal with the problem that everybody viscerally knows is there, you've got to go at it some way with some vehicle.
Well, I'm like,
because
I don't like
even
the majority.
Okay, let's do it.
Well, I'm going to try, and I'll get together with John, and we'll beat it over the head. It will be the first of next week before I can promise to have something for you.